Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Also turned up last week, but here we are. And this is week two with the letter from Birmingham Jail. So last week we started with kind of the historical context for the letter itself. And I invited you to read the letter from Birmingham Jail and the letter that it responds to. So on the day that Martin Luther King was arrested, which was Good Friday of 1963, there was a letter that ran in the Birmingham newspaper written by eight clergy leaders in the area. And it was that letter that stuck in Dr. King's craw so that he wrote the letter from Birmingham Jail. So who read Dr. King's letter? Who? Warren did. All right. Mary Lee did. Jerry is almost there.
Harvey.
Ann and Sue are very close. Russ and Mary started it. Alice is just like, she's auditing, don't worry about her.
That's why I said by Mary Lee.
Okay, who read the letter from the eight clergymen? Much shorter, right? Yeah.
And bigger print.
And bigger print.
Yeah.
So as not to frighten you with Dr. King's letter, I gave you an edition that prints on only six pages. Obviously, yeah, if the print were friendlier, it would print on more pages. But there you are. So what are your immediate reactions, those of you who read Dr. King's letter or the clergy letter that he responds to? Mary Lee.
Okay, when I first read the letter from the, that he responds to, the shorter one.
Yeah.
I thought, well, they have good points. You know, how is he going to...
Right, how is he going to respond to that?
How is he going to respond to those? And then I read his, and it was so well written, and he hit them on the nail, and I thought... He told them.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and his was absolutely right.
Right, yeah.
And if I had been one of these, I would have, gone around with a tail between my legs or something.
Right.
He's right.
Right. Yeah, and so these eight clergymen that he responds to have had through the remainder of their lives really sort of complicated relationships with the letter from Birmingham Jail.
I wonder how they responded to him.
Yeah, so for the most part, they kind of came around to saying, yeah, he was right, he told us. But it was, you know, that would be hard, right? You know, that would be hard to have put your name on something that was so kind of magnificently rebutted, right? As we read the clergy letter, I'll try to differentiate, since we're talking about two different letters here. The clergy letter being the one that was signed by these eight clergymen, then the letter from Birmingham Jail, Dr. King's letter. So when you read the clergy letter, I don't need to put that in the second person. When I read the clergy letter, I hear myself, right? And I think, yeah, that, you know, that makes a good deal of sense, kind of on the surface. And then Dr. King goes beneath the surface of that, right? To say, here's what you're saying in the context in which you're saying it, and what's wrong with what you're saying in the context in which you're saying it. That's why I wanted you to read the clergy letter, because I wanted you to know... on the one hand, the context for Dr. King's letter, and on the other hand, to see just how powerful the letter is as a response to that.
The thought I had reading the clergy letter
It all sounds reasonable, but it sounds like it would take 1,000 years to get any progress.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
If at all.
If at all, right. Yeah, so this sort of slow incremental progress, I suppose that's fine if you're already on the top side of that progress, right? But slow incremental progress is no good for those who actually need the progress to happen. So yeah, it sounds great if you've got time for that. And Dr. King didn't have time for that. Yeah. Okay, so I want to give two really big caveats as we turn to studying the letter itself. We're going to be studying using this document that was, this document and a study guide for it that were put together by Christian Churches Together, which is an ecumenical group working for Christian responses to social issues. And so the first caveat is that there will be a couple of places as I read to you from the study guide that I may quote language from Dr. King's letter that is not in the edition of Dr. King's letter that I gave you. Because there are multiple different editions of the letter that are in circulation, because there were multiple different editions of the letter that were published in some of the major publications that finally picked it up. So the first caveat is that there may be material that I quote that you actually didn't get to read. So if you go back looking for it, you won't find it. I will also read to you from the letter that I distributed to you. But when we come across language that was published somewhere but was not published in the Atlantic, which is where this edition was from, the Atlantic in August of 1963, think about why that language may have appeared somewhere but did not appear in the Atlantic Monthly. Think about sort of the way that given language is chosen for certain audiences, or chosen in that case by certain audiences as they oversaw the publication of the letter.
Is there a place for the source document?
Yes, the source document dated April 19th, I believe, is available. There's a King Center at Stanford, and there's sort of the original such as it is there scanned and uploaded.
So we know which is the
we know what he correct. Wrote at the. Sort of at the first time it was typed up. Really great story about how it was typed up. So Dr. King started the letter in the margins of the newspaper in which the clergy letter was written. Because he read that and was steamed, right? So he starts writing. And then, so he's writing sort of around, how big is the margin of the newspaper?
Yeah.
Right? And he's not a writer, he's a preacher, right? And so his written word is not quite the caliber of his spoken word, and his written word is pretty darn good. His handwriting was not exceptional, according to those who typed the letter. So the letter was sort of written, you know, around the margins with arrows and so forth. Was eventually continued on other paper that was kind of smuggled in, finally on a legal pad where it was finally finished, and then it was smuggled out of the jail was assembled by a typist or two who were working to sort of capture this language and put it together for publication. He intended it for publication. So there is an original. The actual manuscript is largely no longer to be found, because the typist, of course, didn't necessarily know that she was working with a document that would become history, right? She was just trying to get the job done. So a lot of the manuscript is no longer around, but the original typed edition from April is there. You can find it at the King Center at Stanford. But it's actually, because it's old typewriters, it's actually a little bit harder to read than this, and it's definitely harder to search, which was important for getting notes together. So there was an original from April 1963. It was finally picked up for publication in like July, which was after essentially all of the events that we recounted in Birmingham last week. So the letter was written after Dr. King finally said, all right, I'm going to be one of the ones to get arrested. He was ready to be arrested at any point, but that was when it was sort of finally strategic. After he had spent time in jail, I believe after he had even been released from jail, then the Children's March took place, which was really this kind of groundswell of young people, high school and elementary age kids, who said, we're going to go be part of this. That's what finally really turned the tide in Birmingham. And then sometime after that, after the visible success of this campaign in Birmingham, then the mainstream liberal publications started to pick up the letter from Birmingham Jail and publish it. It was yet another month after the Atlantic printed it that there was a horrific bombing at 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham where four little girls were killed. So the history it unfolding in Birmingham was still there, but that was really sort of a last gasp of the progress located in Birmingham. So this got picked up by it got picked up first by a couple of African American publications and a Mennonite publication. Mennonites are always ahead of the rest of us when it comes to peace and justice issues. And then finally it got picked up by like the Christian Century and the New York Times was about to run it, and then I believe the Post, the Washington Post scooped them. The New York Post, which at the time was a liberal publication, it no longer is. So it was finally about June or July that this letter finally actually saw publication. The Atlantic ran it in August, of course, their being a monthly, their timeline is different from the daily newspaper. But again, you know, think about in light of the sort of this idea of, you know, we can take our time on this, right? And in light of the critique that I read from Andre Henry last week, think about what it means that these liberal white publications finally got on board with the letter from Birmingham Jail after Birmingham was visibly a success. What would have changed if the New York Times had picked up the letter from Birmingham Jail and run it on, you know, the Sunday or two after Easter, while the campaign was still in full swing? What would have changed about that and the kind of statement that would have made? So that's a rhetorical question.
So apparently he lost the election. Connor did. I'm just looking up.
Yeah, so this was all like in the midst of a contested mayoral election. So Bull Connor was the police chief, public safety officer, whatever, and was running for mayor. He was mayor and then police chief. I'll have to double check that before I say that on record. But there was a contested election between Bull Connor and the other guy. The other guy probably won, but it was unclear. There were some runoffs, and then there were dueling city halls for a while. So one administration would have a city council meeting, and they would clear out. The other administration would go into the same room, have another city council meeting. So even just sort of the mechanics on the ground are crazy. Trying to sort out who's who and who are we engaging with, who shouldn't we engage with. And so there's the part of what King responds to is something that was still in progress, but the idea that, well, why not just wait for the new administration to take office? And it turned out that the new administration didn't take office by themselves for a good long while, because there was another administration also holding those same offices. So even the white politics of Birmingham were a total mess at the time. And it was in that mess that King was doing his work, and that the coalition surrounding him was doing its work. So I want to really briefly introduce the study guide that we're going to use, and then I want to turn a little bit to the letter itself. So this is a study guide written by Christian Churches Together, which was formed in 2006 as a fellowship of 36 national communions, including African American, Catholic, Evangelical Pentecostal, Historic Protestant, and Orthodox, and seven national organizations, including the American Bible Society, Bread for the World, Evangelicals for Social Action, Habitat for Humanity, the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, Sojourners, and World Vision. So if you're familiar with any of the organizations and denominations described there, this is a pretty big tent, theologically and politically. As leaders of Christian Churches Together in the USA, we have been challenged anew by the letter Dr. King wrote 50 years ago. This was published in 2013, dated April 16th, which is the date of the typed manuscript of the letter. We have been challenged anew by the letter Dr. King wrote 50 years ago to another group of religious leaders while sitting in jail. The letter from Birmingham Jail was written as a response to an open letter to Dr. King that appeared in a local newspaper from eight white clergymen of the state, including bishops, pastors, and a rabbi. They urged an end to the demonstrations and civil disobedience that were occurring in the city, and the use instead of patient negotiation and legal action to address any perceived denial of rights to black citizens. Rather than simply dismissing the concerns raised in the letter from the clergymen or responding with anger, Dr. King addressed them as, quote, fellow clergymen and as, quote, brothers. He writes, since I feel you are men of genuine goodwill and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. He addressed each of their statements, inferences, and assumptions, and also laid out his own disappointments with and vision for the church as an agent of God's justice and peace. Now, I want to be really clear. I'm reading from the Churches Together Today here because I'm going to take issue with what they say. This letter from Birmingham Jail was rapidly picked up by media around the world and was immediately recognized as a document of historic significance. If rapidly you mean some months after the letter was submitted and the events being discussed had completely played themselves out, then sure, rapidly, right? And immediately recognized as a document of historic significance makes it sound like anybody at the moment recognized this as a document of historic significance. So, no, it was eventually picked up by media around the world and has since been recognized as a document of historic significance. This study guide is designed as a small groups tool for us to reinvigorate and in many cases initiate a conversation about the present reality of racism in church and society. So this is going to be the church, in sort of a broad sense, responding to this letter 50 years on. And I am well aware of the irony that we are studying Dr. King's letter through the intermediary of this study guide that was written by, I'm going to say, a predominantly white organization 50 years later. But it's the best study guide I have, so I'm going to work with it here. So what they do in their study guide is they pull out little snippets from the letter and then offer a little response to that snippet. And then there's a study guide with questions that are, again, kind of responding to their own response. So I'm going to try to sort of curate those in a way that helps them remain relevant for us. So I'm going to read two paragraphs from the beginning of the letter from Birmingham Jail, and we're going to talk a little bit about addressing the causes of injustice, not just the symptoms of injustice. So Dr. King begins, "While confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling our present activities, quote, unwise and untimely. Seldom, if ever, do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas. If I sought to answer all of the criticisms that cross my desk, my secretaries would be engaged in little else in the course of their day, and I would have no time for constructive work. But since I feel that you are men of genuine goodwill and your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I would like to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms." And then skipping to the last paragraph before that next section break. "You deplore the demonstrations that are presently taking place in Birmingham, but I am sorry that your statement did not express a similar concern for the conditions that brought the demonstrations into being. I am sure that each of you would want to go beyond the superficial social analyst who looks merely at effects and does not grapple with the underlying causes. I would not hesitate to say that it is unfortunate that so-called demonstrations are taking place in Birmingham at this time, but I would say in more emphatic terms that it is even more unfortunate that the white power structure of this city left the Negro community with no other alternative." And the Christian Churches Together response: "The tendency to focus on symptoms rather than causes persists in our day. There is a danger of naively believing that the systemic causes of poverty among African Americans and other disadvantaged groups either never existed or have already been dealt with, and that current social problems may thus be attributed primarily to the choices of individuals. Without diminishing the importance of personal responsibility, we dare not negate or neglect the persistent systemic factors embedded in our laws, economic structures, and popular culture that reinforce deep-seated racial disparities. As Dr. King recognized, the debilitating reality of systemic injustice in a racialized society leads to pent-up resentments and latent frustrations among African Americans, which too often find release in destructive, often self-destructive ways. If we deal only with these surface expressions of pain, whether through the criminal justice system or through ministries of personal transformation alone, and fail to grapple with the underlying causes, we will never achieve the goals espoused by Dr. King." So a question. We've talked a lot through this year about economic disparities in the United States, and I would add around the world. So a question, is racism a cause or a symptom of the widening economic disparity in the United States, and why? Is racism a cause or a symptom of the widening economic disparity in the United States?
I think it's a cause.
You think it's a cause?
I think it's a cause. I think the disparity is caused by a lot of decisions made by a lot of people. In many cases, based on racism, even though they may not realize it and would definitely deny it.
Mm-hmm. So it is possible to make decisions that are racist without wanting to be a racist oneself.
Consciously, yes.
Consciously, yeah.
I'll take the opposite. I'll say that it could be a symptom because there are as many, my mind says, how many poor whites are there versus poor blacks.
Uh-huh.
And there are a lot of poor whites in this country, too. So now the whites and the blacks are deciding who's better off between the poor, and we get into this.
Yeah.
This, I forget the psychological or philosophical term of wanting to have someone below you. So.
Right. Yeah. So if so there's the question of is racism a way of in this case is it a way for poor white folks to position someone else as worse than them.
Right.
So, it's an interesting question. And I think the roots of racism are going to continue to be, are going to be really bound up, at least, with the roots of economic inequality. And probably partly for that reason, yeah.
Because the fact is there's a lot of poor whites, too.
Right.
When you talk about it, I'm getting off the subject a little bit, your question, but King was starting to focus, as you were telling me last week,
right,
on poverty.
Right, yeah, he was starting to,
his white and black.
Yeah, his focus was more clearly becoming around the structures that make poverty inescapable. When we talk about poor whites and poor blacks, it's important for us to bear in mind the difference between absolute numbers and proportions. Because on the one hand, we could say, X million white people living in poverty, X million people of color living in poverty, which number is bigger? But that's the wrong number to work with. We have to look at rates and distributions, and so what proportion of people of color live in poverty as opposed to what proportion of white people live in poverty in order to really sort of identify these systemic issues. Because if there are, if there are 30 people in your class and 25 of them are white and I don't know, let's say 9 of them live in poverty, and there are 5 people of color in your class, and 4 of them live in poverty. 9 is not bigger than 4 in that case, right?
Nothing's black and white.
Right, yeah, there's, so the way that racism and economic inequality play together is gonna be complicated, yeah. And the way that race is structured as a way of differentiating people from each other is going to have a lot of bearing on sort of where people position themselves economically too. So yeah, some of both, but the legal structures that make racism an economic thing, Russ is right, Those are decisions that go a long, long way back. And it is possible for people who don't otherwise think of themselves as racists to uphold the structures that make for racism, and to really want those to stay in place. That's part of where I hear myself in the clergy. So Dr. King is talking about not just the symptoms of inequality, but the causes of inequality. I think he would continue to have some things to say to us in a 21st century when there are still voices honoring secessionists of the 19th century as heroes and public spaces flying the Confederate flag today. Dr. King was attacked as unpatriotic, both in the context of Birmingham and in the wider context of his work. What does it mean to be patriotic in the 21st century when 19th century secessionists are still hailed by many as heroes and the Confederate flag still flies freely? What does it mean to be patriotic? What would Dr. King say it means to be patriotic in that context?
I think in what's currently happening, patriotic from the establishment standpoint is to not buck the status quo. For example, with Kaepernick, I believe his name was, that taking a knee during the national anthem, and also any of the other kinds of things that you're not a patriot if you don't back the whole power structure the way it currently is. No, let's not do anything. On the other hand, I think Dr. King's philosophy is you're more patriotic if you're kind of like a Nathan Hale of give me liberty or give me death kind of situation, which if you think about it, those are going to be two things that are a great loggerheads, which is what that is, where the clergy was not thinking that they should do anything that would affect the status quo.
Right.
Versus Dr. King, who thinks it's time to do something and bring it to the forefront.
Right. Yeah. So, and you know, you recall somebody like Nathan Hale, who we hail him as a patriot, right? What was he at the time?
He was a traitor.
A traitor. Yeah. So, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure, one man's treason is another man's patriotism, right? And so we have to choose between patriotisms, is part of what Dr. King's going to say. Can I, I'm going to turn us to another couple of paragraphs from the letter here. This is on page 3 if you're reading along. It's still on page 3 if you're not. And I'm going to begin with the paragraph at the very top, and then I'm going to jump to a paragraph in the middle of the page. Dr. King writes, "You express a great deal of anxiety over our willingness to break laws. This is certainly a legitimate concern. Since we so diligently urge people to obey the Supreme Court's decision of 1954 outlawing segregation in the public schools, it is rather strange and paradoxical to find us consciously breaking laws. One may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer is found in the fact that there are two types of laws. There are just laws, and there are unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all." He gives a number of examples. These are just a few examples of unjust and just laws. There are some instances when a law is just on its face and unjust in its application. For instance, I was arrested Friday on a charge of parading without a permit. Now, there is nothing wrong with an ordinance which requires a permit for a parade, But when the ordinance is used to preserve segregation and to deny citizens the First Amendment privilege of peaceful assembly and peaceful protest, then it becomes unjust. Dr. King's letter offers us two specific criteria for any public policy. Is this a law that, this is quoting a different portion of the letter, distorts the soul and damages the personality? And was this law developed without the opportunity for full participation by those it affects? We must therefore evaluate not only the specific content of our laws, but the ongoing barriers to equitable participation in our democracy. Unfortunately, in many ways, these barriers seem to be self-reinforcing rather than eroding over time. Even under the watch of an African-American president, African-Americans and other disadvantaged groups have been at risk of being divested of their voice by powerful interest groups. So, an unjust law is a law that distorts the soul and damages the personality, and or it's a law that was developed without the opportunity for full participation by those it affects. And Dr. King spends a lot of time on page 3 there, really sort of working out what he means by that. So, what do you think of those criteria for saying is a law just or unjust?
I'm bothered about one thing we keep talking about, the blacks. How about our American Indians?
Okay,
anybody
I want to stay
treated awful.
Vera, I want to stay focused on, okay, on Dr. King's letter. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
What do you make of these two criteria? A law is unjust if it distorts the soul and damages the personality, or it is imposed by a majority on a minority that doesn't have equal access to participation in the process.
Well, I think it's right, and the one thing is that the minority does not have much of an opportunity to do anything except protest the law to bring it into focus.
Right.
The laws were made by white men.
The laws were made by white men. And the 8 white men who wrote the clergy letter wanted the laws to be changed through the same process that had made those laws in the first place. And Dr. King points out that if you don't have reasonable access to the political process, then what are you going to do except protest? Yeah. Are there other criteria that you would want to include in determining whether a law is just or unjust?
Well, he uses the term immoral frequently, and that when you're used the phrase affect the personality and whatever else. Those are pretty powerful kinds of statements in terms of what is fair, what is equitable, what is kind, and what are all the opposites.
Right.
So it kind of throws the burden back to everyone to make some kind of decision on almost everything that they encounter.
It also said somewhere, if the tables were turned, would it be fair if it were totally the opposite?
Right.
If the white men were the ones being put down.
Right. Yeah, what would it look like if the laws were structured in such a way that that it was whites who didn't have access to the process? Yeah. So Dr. King quotes St. Augustine, who says, an unjust law is no law at all. He knows that he's having that conversation in the context of a debate where these segregation laws were deemed to be just by the white power structures that had put them in place, but not by Dr. King. So are there laws today that you would not call unjust, but somebody else would call unjust? Justice is not always a clear-cut thing.
Sure, the voting for ex-felons.
Okay. So, and there's debate about whether, sort of whether and under what circumstances ex-felons should be, should have their right to vote restored. So yeah, there's a place where one person might say, that's totally fair, and somebody else might say that's completely unjust. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking of two things. One is everybody's equal in the law, but the law is so complicated that unless you have an advocate, a lawyer, you're at a disadvantage. So we see this all the time, you know.
Right.
And the other is, for better or for worse, the law is selectively enforced.
Okay. Yeah.
I can give you an example of that. So it's a law that if you are found with a pill on you that it's not in the prescription pill, that it's not in the prescription container, and that's illegal.
Right.
Whether you knew that or not. And a lot of people carry pills around with them, and I do too.
Right.
And I found out about this from one of my patients who knew about this.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean to drag on and on and on about it as well. And I said, it's interesting that he would know that. So I asked a policeman about that. He says, yes, that's true, but we only enforce it on people we don't like.
Right.
So again, I mean, they may have good intentions for doing it this way, but still it's selectively enforced.
Right.
So,
that's refreshing honesty from the police officer, right?
Yeah.
A minor, what would be a minor infraction, right? Having a prescription pill in something other than the prescription container. And you could understand why that might be necessary, right? That could be a just law in the sense that it serves a public good to keep controlled substances, powerful prescription drugs off the streets. They're easier to track if you keep them in the original container, so forth. On the other hand, who's going to get picked up for that? The numbers that I can't quote the numbers, but I've seen them. For instance, rates of illicit drug use. Just look at marijuana, for instance. Rates of marijuana use are pretty constant across racial lines, but people of color are far, far more likely to be arrested and charged with illicit use of marijuana. That's probably also the case for illicit use of prescription drugs, and probably for a lot of the same reasons. So it is possible, that's where Dr. King was saying, it's possible for a law to be just on its face and to be unjust in its application. So I'm gonna leave that right there for the week. We'll come back next week and learn about the personal dimensions of this political conversation and what it means to be an extremist. So finish reading the letter if you can this week, and we will come back next week.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.